This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Women's Wednesday here on Mind Talk. Every Wednesday, we have an opportunity to meet another woman and to hear another woman's story and learn about another woman's path. Today is no different. I'm very pleased to introduce to you Phyllis Lawson, who is the author of... Phyllis, why don't you tell us the name of your book?
Yes, the name of my memoir is Quilt of Souls.
And tell us about the Quilt of Souls.
Well, it's basically a memoir, and I'm going to call it my memoir as well as my grandmother Lula Horn's memoir. She was born in 1883, and she raised me from the time I was 4 years old. I'm originally from Michigan. I was born in 1953. However, it was during that time where it was the Great Migration, where a lot of blacks went north. And my mother and father were a product of that Great Migration of the 50s. But after all, a lot of family members, they trace their way up north, and then they start running into financial difficulty, having too many children, trying to locate jobs. Sometimes a child or two gets sent down south, and my mother had six children, and I think I got caught up with my parents having too many kids too soon, so I guess they just couldn't afford me. So I was sent down south to very rural Alabama in 1957, and there I was with my grandparents, who I've never met before in my life, and at that point I felt abandoned, because you're taken away from an environment that you're 4 years old, you know, your thought process is just not there. So I had some serious abandonment issues. So my grandmother specifically, was a quilter. She was born in 1883, and through the making of quilts, I was able to do some healing, because the quilts that she made told stories of people's lives. She would only put people's clothes in of people who had passed on. So her quilt told stories of her ancestors and her loved ones. And we would sit in the front yard, and she would put pieces of these people's clothing into this quilt. And each piece she put in, she would tell the story of their life, of how they lived and how they died. And I was 4 years old, and I'm listening to these stories. So over the course of those 9 years that I was with my grandmother, she told the same story over and over and over again, and she made this beautiful quilt that I still have today, and it has people's clothes. And not only that, that's the first part of the story, but the second part of the story, without giving away too much, at the age of almost 12, again, I was taken from my grandmother and sent back up north with my mother. My mother just came and grabbed me. I didn't know what was going on. I was still a child. I was a preteen, and I felt abandoned once again. You know, it's okay. What you abandoned once, but then being abandoned and having these feelings two times in your life at that young age was very, very. It affected my life a whole lot.
I'm sure it would. Let me stop you there, because I'd like to go back to more of the beginning, if you will. In your book, The Quilt of Souls, your story actually begins at the age of four. So I'd like for you to take us to that day as best you can, that you... in 1 minute were at home with your family, mm-hmm. and in the next minute you were in a car with strangers being driven to you knew not where.
You know, and my theory is when you're that young, either one or two things are going to happen. Either you're going to block all those memories out, or you're going to remember them very well. And I remember that day when I was just... a car pulled up in my front yard. My sister was putting yellow ribbons in my hair. And the next thing I knew, I was getting inside this black car. My sister said you had to go with them. My parents were nowhere to be found. And all I remember is these large people. But when you're very little, adults just seem large, especially when you have two people in the back seat and you're sitting in the middle of them. And all I remember is the chatter. And the later it got, you know, when you're a kid, that's exciting for a minute. But then after that, you know, 4, 5, 6 hours go by, you're beginning to say, you know, something is wrong. You're beginning to miss your parents and you're in the environment that you become accustomed to. And all of a sudden, I'm seeing dirt roads and the whole scenery, you know, began to change. And I landed on this farm, and it had changed dramatically by then because my grandparents had no running water, no indoor toilets, and so it was, you know, no indoor plumbing, I should say, and animals and chicken and all the wildlife that I had never seen before in my life.
So it was hugely different. Hugely
different. It was very different. It was a transition. It was a great transition.
Describe for us, if you will, the home that you left in Detroit, Michigan. What was that like?
It was, we lived in a neighborhood that was fairly mixed. I mean, it was a mixture of white, black, Italians and Greeks who had came over, and they had a large Greek population.
Okay.
And so at the time I was four, I played with kids who didn't look like me. It was tree-lined streets, white frame homes, green grass. We had indoor toilets. My parents worked all the time. I barely saw my parents, and I was a twin. So my oldest sister took care of us while my parents was there. So during that time, you know, I think my parents worked 12, 15 hours a day. And when I did see them, they would come in and go to sleep. So I didn't see a whole lot of, you know, much of my parents. So for me and my other younger sisters and brothers, our sisters, my older sisters and the one right below my other sister, they were responsible of caretaking.
How many children were there? How many siblings did you have?
It was six of us.
Six, all right.
It ended up to be eight because two more were born after I left. But it was six of us when I left.
So you went from a household that was really full. I mean, it was full of children,
yes,
and from your experience, but it was really full. And then all of a
yes
sudden, it was a full neighborhood. People lived close by. You could walk outside of your front door and see trees and grass and people. And then
yes
all of a sudden, in the course of several hours, you're in a place that is almost 1,000%, if not 2,000%, different from what
yes
you knew
totally
just a few hours ago. And, you
yes
know, the sense that adults used to have that children are young and they don't know anything and you don't
mm-hmm
have to talk to them was, in fact, I mean, we now know that is not true, but
right
your experience of sort of being snatched up and taken from one place and dropped into another, that was something that happened more often than I think we realize in this day and
oh
age.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because children were seen and not heard back then. You know, you really wasn't allowed to ask an adult a question.
Right.
You know, you kind of get what you would, whatever adult said, that was it. That was firm, and that didn't change. And, you know, no one even attempted it. I know I didn't, to ask a question. That's why I didn't ask any questions about where I'm going, who are these people, and why am I going. I didn't ask any questions because that was my upbringing. That was the mores for that era, that you just didn't question adults.
Right. You just did whatever they told you to do.
Yes, exactly.
So waking up the first night and the first morning that you woke up in your new home, did you know at that point that was going to be your home? Did you think it was a visit? What did you think was going on at 4 years?
I was really confused because, again, nobody really sat down and explained to you, you know, that you would be leaving your home to go and live with your grandparents for X amount of years. And so I didn't ask any questions. So as the time went by, I was always looking for that return visit from my parents to come back and get me, or my sister, I would look up and my sister would be there, but that never happened. And like you say, when time heals wounds, that's pretty much what healed mine. That and my grandmother, she was such an amazing woman, but she kind of like, she was very soothing, and I never even asked her would I be going back home. So that part of my life never did happen. So years went by. I remember my mother coming down once, and I think that was maybe after a year, and I was so afraid that I remember hiding under the bed and I wouldn't come out, and my mother didn't know why I was like that, and my grandmother didn't know, so they pretty much left me under the bed, and I can't even tell you why I did that. You know, I guess that was one of those childish things, being afraid. A year go by and you feel like you're going to be taken again, right? Especially after you've become accustomed to your grandmother and the healing that in my young life, the healing that I've went through, I've become accustomed to my environment. And that was a pretty a pretty shocking environment when you don't have any neighbors, you know, no neighbors, and you're walking 2 and 3 miles to school, and so that's a tough transition for a little child. So,
you know, there are many folks who are listening to us right now as we speak, and the idea of indoor versus indoor plumbing versus no plumbing just doesn't exist. I mean, that's something that happened like 20,000 years ago. What was that transition like for you?
Well, I remember in the middle of the night, we had what we called, I hate to sound crass, but a slop jar that was set next to the bed. And the slop jar is for you to do, you know, if you have to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, you would just, it was a big white, I guess it was aluminum jar.
Okay.
That sat there. And the grandpapa was the only person that could do number twos. If I had to do a number two, I had to go to the middle of the cotton field with the outhouse. And I hated that because I would have to get up in the middle of the night, and my grandfather was really good at telling ghost stories. So you tell a ghost story, and then here I have to get up in the middle of the night to go out to the cotton field. That was traumatic for me. That was one of the worst things. But, just going through that transition, not only the bathroom facilities, but you also had no heat, that you turn the button and the heat come on. My grandfather would have to get up in the morning and make a fire in order for us to get up out of the bed, you know, so we wouldn't freeze to death. And so you're working with all that as a kid, but then you become so accustomed to that. We didn't, you know, we light a lantern to see our way around, you know, when I had to get up and go in the middle of the cotton field. My grandmother would get up, and she went with me for the first year, but after that I was pretty much on my own. But we have to light a lantern to go out, to have light so we can see what we're doing. And then you have the rats and the snakes that's in the wall that you hear all night, you know. And I remember my first few weeks there, I would hear these rats and snakes just clawing in the walls like they were fighting each other. And it used to scare me, and my grandmother would say, "No, don't bother. They won't bother you. You don't bother them." So I began to sleep like a baby, just like they did, because the sounds would put me to sleep. So it was a lot. You know, the kids today, I don't think they could go through that. You know, then walking to school for 3 miles, and you know, we only had a 2-room school, and the books were horrible. We had fun with Dick and Jane, but we got the leftover books from the white schools. So, you know, when we get the books, they would be all tore up. And, you know, so, I look back at some of those things and I say, wow, I don't see how I made it through those 9 years down South country. You know, and then you have to deal with the racism and that sort of thing.
What was that like for you, you know, for those 9 years? I mean, clearly you came from a multicultural environment. As you described a moment ago, you were playing with kids who looked like you, who didn't look like you. I mean, that was just your life, and then all of a sudden, mm-hmm. it's very different. What did you think of that change in your life?
You know, I had to. I really had to sit back and really think about that, because the kids were different. Because they made me feel different. And even though they were in the same situation as I was, a lot of those kids, which I didn't know until much later on, that they were being raised by their grandparents, and all the time I thought it was their parents.
Okay.
But I think they singled me out because I was the new kid on the block. My grandmother would make my clothes out of clothes of dead people, too. So, you know, I know I looked a hot mess, you know, a lot of times. And a lot of the kids would bring Vienna sausage in the can or potted meat in the can, and my grandmother would just, you know, put a piece of mystery meat in between a biscuit, and that was my lunch that I would take to school. So kids would laugh at me because I would have to bring back, my grandmother used to make me bring back the same paper bag, greasy paper bag, I don't care how greasy it got, but I would have to fold that bag up and bring it back every single day. So I was singled out because I was different, because I was new, and my grandmother was kind of like a little tad behind the other kids' grandmothers. You know, even though they didn't have any running water or no outside toiletries, but, you know, their lunches was better, and they dressed a little better than I did. So, you know, when kids that age, they have a habit of kind of like pointing out, you
sure.
know, even comparing themselves to somebody that's different. And so I got pretty much caught up in that. But not seeing people of other cultures or different races and colors was confusing. And I, after a while, I just didn't even think about it. I became acclimated to my environment, to that school environment that I was in. And I excelled. I began to excel in that environment, even though I was singled out and kids would talk about me. But I excelled because I always told stories, the same stories that my grandmother told me. So I pretty much excelled in that environment.
So you became almost a surrogate storyteller.
Yes, exactly. Because my grandmother would tell me the stories, and I would get to school, and I would tell the same story, and my teacher loved me, and she just kind of like singled me out. You know, I later found out, Dr. Brewer, that this teacher who took me under her wing, she was a cousin on my father's side. I didn't even realize that until once I had left. I mean, I think I was about 30 years old when I found that out.
Amazing.
And because I always wanted to know, why did she treat me so well? Because she was very heavy-handed woman. And a lot of students didn't like her because she was very gruff, but she treated me so well. And I really appreciate that a lot. I think she made me into the person she was. Actually, she was very instrumental in my storytelling and the way I can express myself in words and thoughts.
But, you know, even that was a difference between you and the children in your class. So I would think that even
yes.
that had you as a target of being singled out by your friends. Well, maybe
yes,
not so friendly.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And I think the kids kind of picked up on that because I would get called a teacher's pet, which it really didn't bother me because I really loved Miss Clay. I loved her a lot. And we go back to talking about how, you know, the difference between, even though I hadn't started the school in Detroit when I was four, but I noticed later on how, you know, and that the hand-me-downs of the books and because I never saw white kids until later on, much later after I had been down south for a little while.
Interesting.
And it was so long later that when I saw these little white kids, it kind of scared me. It's like, who are these kids? Because I didn't see them when my grandfather would take me, and we would go into town to get, you know, what little things we did buy from the store. But my grandfather would always give me the cautious, give me the cautions about do not drink water from this water fountain. You drink at this water fountain, and you stay here and you don't move. So I would always get the get the speech, get the spiel before I go into town, because it, you know, and it's probably one of the things that saved my life, because I was such a freewheeling kid, you know.
Saved your life and yet constricted your life all at the same time.
Yes.
Phyllis, we're going to
exactly.
take a break, but when we come back, I would like for you to tell us a little bit about Great Aunt Bessie. She sounds like she was something else.
Okay.
We'll
I
be
sure
right
will.
Back. You are listening to Mind Talk. I'm Pamela Brewer, and we continue the conversation with Phyllis Lawson, who is the author of Quilt of Souls. Phyllis, talk to us about Great Aunt Bessie.
Oh, wow. Great Aunt Bessie would be considered way above her time in today's world. One thing I have to go back to, just preface this with, During those days of living with my grandmother, we lived in a house that was kind of set way off the ground with cinder blocks, and you know, as we discussed before, children weren't allowed to sit around adults and talk, and you know, and listen to them talk, and let alone ask them a question or you know about something that was considered adult like. So I would crawl up under the house and just watch these women as they would come and sit in my grandmother's yard. And from up under the house, they couldn't see me because it was dark. So I would crawl from the back of the house to the front of the house where I can see them right there in this circle in the front yard, sitting around talking about everything. And that's why I got the best information from sitting around listening to them talk. I would just, when they would laugh, I would laugh, even though I didn't know what I was hearing. But over the years, as I got older, I was able to put these things in an adult perspective. But one thing in common that my grandmother, one thing in common with all the women that would show up in my grandmother's yard, they all appeared to be very strong women. And I was telling a friend of mine that a couple of those women were almost 100 years old, and these women were born in slavery. And I didn't know that at the time, but as later on in life, I understood, wow, I wish I could ask them a question about their experiences, even though they were babies. But, you know, I know their parents had passed on things to them.
Sure.
But my Aunt Bessie was one of those women who would show up in my grandmother's yard. She was, my grandfather had 16 sisters and brothers, and she was like the middle girl of in that family of 16. So she was one of the ones that would show up. You could see her coming miles down the road. She would have this big walking stick, and she would be walking like Moses. She had two long braids on each side. Fair skin, because my grandfather's mother was mixed. So Aunt Bessie would come and she would sit in the front yard, and she was just very brazen, just very outspoken. And her father had cut her off of any inheritance because she was so brazen and she wouldn't stay in that woman's role, so to speak. And Aunt Bessie had two or three husbands, and nobody ever knew what happened to them.
Uh-oh.
But she lived alone in the middle of the woods, and she had we'll call her the banker. because she kept all her money, thousands of dollars, in her apron pocket, and she had a gun in her other pocket. And everybody knew that Aunt Bessie didn't take no mess. So, and my grandfather was the only person who could kind of calm her down when she got beside herself. And so she would come there, she would talk, and she would she was so outspoken. She never failed. She would get in an argument with one person, one of those women, before she would leave and go on her way back home. You know, that was just Aunt Bessie's way. But she was, you know, she was a different type of woman. She was very outspoken. I bet you, if in this day and age, I can see Aunt Bessie being a banker or a lawyer, because that was just her mannerism. I learned a lot from her, and a part of me wanted to be like her, to be outspoken. And she was one of those women that I learned resiliency from, you know, and that. I don't want to give away the book, but she was one of those women that had such a positive impression on me that later on in my life, it came back as a benefit to me later on in how I got through some of the struggles that I went through later on in my life.
Well, let's do a huge fast forward and okay. Go back to, there came a time when you went back to Detroit, as you were speaking mm-hmm. about earlier, again, sort of unceremoniously, one minute you're here and the next minute you're there. At that point, you were how old, and where were you in school at that point?
I was 11 years old. I would have been turning 12 that year. I went back in the summer, and I would have been turning 12 that year. And I was in the sixth. I was going to go into the seventh grade, I believe.
All right.
And
now,
so
what...
that was.
Please continue.
Oh, I'm sorry. That was very traumatic for me, because it was almost like the same way that I was pulled away initially, but this time I think it was a bit more traumatic, because I had to watch my grandmother cry, and that you can tell that it hurt her, and there was no warning that I was leaving. Just my mother showed up and said that we're taking you back to Detroit, and I was so hurt. I mean, that day, and that was why it was so difficult writing that chapter, because, you know, the quote FDR that day will go down in as infamy for me, because that was very traumatic. And then I wasn't able to take my quilt with me, and I remember on the bus with my mother, neither one of us said anything, and then just got taken and placed in an environment that was just very, very different for me. I had the seven other sisters and brothers whom I had to get to know, and they were strangers to me. And you know, half of them treated me so bad, because I was, again, here I am, you know, just like going to school when I was young. Here, once again, I'm trying to acclimate myself to a group of individuals that I knew nothing about. And this was home that I would be living for the rest of, well, at least until I got old enough to leave. And my mother was very abusive. I mean, physically and mentally abusive. I mean, in the book I talk about that, but I kind of downplay it a little bit, basically making up excuses for why she was abusive, you know, because I've forgiven and I've moved on from that. But it came to the point where I just could no longer stay at home, because the abuse was that bad.
Let me ask you this. And let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. You said earlier that you were born and grew up in a time when there were a number of African American families who, because mm-hmm. the families were growing larger than the income, felt the mm-hmm. need to send, you know, the children off to live with another relative. When you left, you were one of six. But when you came
yes.
back, you were one of more than six. So
yes.
how did you kind of think about that? I mean, life truly marched on in your absence. Mm-hmm. What was that like for you?
Well, you know, I had another sister who was an older sister and an older brother who were my older sister, the one who was doing my hair at the time, she was sent away to an aunt in Ohio, but she was treated so bad they ended up sending her back. And I came up in the era where there was, my parents definitely subscribed to that light skin, dark skin kind of philosophy.
Talk about that if you would.
Yeah. Well, the lighter skinned kids were treated much better than the darker skinned kids. We were, and it was very recognizable that we were being treated that way because of our skin color. And my mother pretty much, I mean, it was, even though she would use the terminology kind of, oh, I love all my kids, but she really, it was really so apparent. In a blatantly apparent that she treated the lighter skinned kids better than the darker skinned kids. And my other older sister had to grow up in that environment too. That's why she left at such a young age. She was 18. She married a person just to get away from the abuse of my mother. And that went on a lot. During that era, I mean, it was we became accustomed to that. It was almost like a something that, because I had other friends who would talk about the same thing. Well, we're the darker skinned kids, so we're not going to get X, Y, and Z. It was almost unacceptable. It was almost acceptable to think that way, you know, which is really, really wrong. But that was that era, you know. Unfortunately, you know, and I have friends today who. Will kind of deny that did actually occur within the black community, even though it was a well-known practice.
And unfortunately still occurs today in some communities.
Yeah.
So exactly. As you were growing up, again, there's just so much. So here you are, you're taken, you're returned. You go from being in a multiracial environment to essentially a single race environment. Now you're back in perhaps a multiracial environment. But now we're looking at colorism and what's going on with that. How did you understand, if you understood as a child, the distinctions that were being made between parents and their own children? How did it impact your self-esteem?
Well, first I had to get. I was numb. I was very numb when I came back to a lot of things. I mean, I had almost. I was at the point that I didn't matter. You know, I was just an object, and I really didn't matter. Nobody wanted me. You know, issues of abandonment is very powerful and very impactful for a person. That age, you know, it really was. So I just considered that I just didn't matter to anybody or anyone, you know. And I, at that point, I didn't know whether I was coming back because all of a sudden my grandmother didn't want me, which was actually not the case. But at that age, you really don't even think about that. All you think about is you're placed back in an environment again. Here you are again. Somebody didn't want you. So, and that was the only thing on my mind. Even going to school, I didn't matter. I just sat in the back of the class and just did nothing. And that's why when people read this book, you know, and I didn't know it until I actually wrote it down and people start commenting on it, it just covers so much the helplessness, the hopelessness, the homeless, suicide thoughts, the abandonment. Physical and emotional abuse, you know, just discouraged and dismayed and deep despair, you know, all of those emotions all kind of like smothered me at one time, you know, and I was only 11 or 12 years old. And so when you have all that, and on top of that, you know, you're getting beat every day, you know, and you don't even know why, you know, you go into that flight or fight syndrome. And I found solace by just leaving, just running away. Didn't know where I was going. I was sleeping here, there, and everywhere. And I think it was the only reason that I can actually say that I'm alive today is while I was living out on the street, living in bus stations and libraries and everywhere else I could find that I can find somewhere to sneak in and sleep. I thought about my grandmother and all the stories that she told about her sister Ella, who went through some really terrible things with racism and prejudice, and the stories that she told of those people's clothes that are in that quilt. Mm-hmm. That's what kept me alive. All these people just kind of like picked me up and put me in a place where I needed to be, symbolically speaking.
You know,
and
you,
that was the only thing that saved me.
You talk, I mean, clearly you express the resilience that was just all a part of you. Mm-hmm. You also reference being homeless for a period of time. And mm-hmm. I pick up on that because so many times we see people in the streets today as we speak who certainly appear to be homeless, and many of them mm-hmm. are homeless. And very often the sense is, you know, they're just bad people, they're just lazy, they're drug addicts, mm-hmm. you know, all of these negative things. And in fact, there are many people who are homeless because home is simply not a safe, survivable
exactly.
environment.
Exactly. And that's why, Dr. Burrell, once I recovered from all these things that I was going through, and my recovery came in the form of going into the military, I think that was another thing that saved my life. And that's why after I left the military the first time, all I wanted to do was to be a counselor and help a social worker and help other people who went through the same things that were, you know, the similar things. And well, that's all I wanted to do.
Let's talk about that military experience okay. for a moment. And okay. and I'm just going to ask you if you would okay. to speak directly into the phone, because I'm losing
okay.
you every now and then.
You
joined the Air Force after graduating from high school, and you were one of the first female B-52 mechanics. Talk about that.
Well, I was homeless at the time, and I was walking around Detroit and, you know, crying and not knowing what I was going to do next. And up appeared this military recruiting station, and I walked in, and this Air Force guy grabbed me. He said, you know, start asking me some basic questions. And I told him, I said, I don't have anywhere to go. I'm basically homeless. Told him my whole sob story about, you know, my parents and living in the country. I mean, this man knew my entire story. So he said, you know what, we're going to get you in the military, and we're going to try to find somewhere for you to stay in the interim. And that's exactly what he did. I took the test, I passed it, and, you know, I was thinking more like doing typing and bookkeeping and accounting, something girly-like, something more feminine. And when he told me that I would be an aircraft mechanic, one of the first ones, because Nixon, I guess the ink was still wet on the paper that Nixon had signed that they needed to open up these non-traditional fields to women. Mm-hmm. So I was his quota. I met his quota. And I probably only passed the electronic and the mechanic portion with a 20. And he said, oh, don't worry about it. You did good. You're going to make a fine B-52 mechanic. I said, oh. And, you know, I just couldn't get past this aircraft mechanic with working with tools, and because I didn't know the difference between a screwdriver and a wrench. And here I am.
I think you probably have a lot of company there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And then when I got there, I was the only woman in the class. And I'm looking around saying, where are all the other women? And those were the years of the true male chauvinist, because they would say, don't worry about it, we got you, we're going to help you through this, we know you don't want to break your nails and stuff, so we're going to help you do X, Y, and Z, and, you know, we know you just want to sit around and look pretty, and, you know, so I got all those kind of comments, something that really wouldn't be tolerated today, you know, even though we know that there's still sexual harassment.
Absolutely.
But not to this. I mean, this was like blatant. And I finished and I got through that class and got to my first base in the middle of the desert in California, just in time to go to Vietnam, go to Thailand, and because that was right before the fall of Saigon, and I helped patch up these planes to bring them back. And since I was the only female riding in a B-52 all the way to Thailand, as soon as that plane would land on a Friday, I wouldn't see these guys anymore until Monday morning, because, you know, they would go find a mamazon, and here I am just stuck in a Quonset hut, just basically by myself. So that was the story of my life, you know, on four different occasions, would make these 2 and 3 week trips to Thailand.
You know, what's striking is how many times there were experiences of abandonment in your life. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit more about the work that you did with incarcerated youth and victims of domestic violence. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We'll be right back. Phyllis, you, at some point in your life, after all that you had been through, you decided to put yourself, quite frankly, in the way of more trauma by working with incarcerated youth and victims of domestic violence, both the youth and adults, and also those suffering with alcohol and substance abuse. Can you give us kind of a thumbnail sketch of how those years impacted you?
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to go into that field, because I really, really felt that I could help someone. I really did, because I know what I had went through during my adolescence and childhood and adulthood. And I wanted to, this was my way of giving back. And plus, there was a passion that I had. You know, it was something that was compelling me to do this. It wasn't, you know, how some people will say, well, you know, I'll just go and do this as a job just to have, not me. I wanted to do this because this was a passion that I had to help others who were going through some of the same situations that I had once went through. And I really felt, having went through some of these things, that I would be really good at helping others to overcome some of the same obstacles that I had to overcome. So I started out working with the state of Maryland Department of Corrections. You know, of course, you had to take the test and I get on the list. And I once I got that job with Maryland Corrections, people would really laugh at me, saying, "Well, you know," because I always told them I was going to come in this prison system and just change people's lives, and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. I was one of those rose-colored glasses people, even though I had been through that, but I just had this intense desire that I could really help somebody. So they said, "I guess we'll fix you." So they started me out in Department of Corrections, but they started me up on death row. They call it the Maryland. It was in Jessup, the Maryland Penitentiary, and it was like, oh my goodness,
what a place to start.
This was orientation. So And I guess it got to the point where those guys said, you know, one guy actually told his guard and asked could they push up their date to die, because I was really, really worrying them to death. I could not believe that this guy said that. Like, oh my goodness. And this was back in the 1980s. So I really enjoyed working with that population. And then from there I got into the field I really wanted to, the population I really wanted to work with, which was the juveniles out at the Charles H. Hickey School. They used to call it the Maryland Training School for Boys. So I was there for years, and I mean, I really excelled working with the kids. And other counselors would say, wow, I don't know how she get these kids to do X, Y, and Z, because I've been there, because a lot of those kids had been abandoned. And it was really an experience. And then from there, I started working. I left and I went to Fairfax County Alcohol and Drug Services and start working with adults and juveniles who were placed there by the court.
And that was in Virginia?
Treatment. Yes, okay. That was in Virginia.
Okay.
And I also worked privately for Vanguard Services, which is also alcohol and substance abuse, as well as women who were abused, victims of domestic violence. And I really, really enjoyed working with that population. And then when 9/11, well, right before 9/11 happened, someone talked me to going into the National Guard, and I went into the National Guard and was deployed for 9/11. So I just pretty much spent the rest of my time on active duty, and that was, I mean, it was another transition that I had to make, but I knew I wanted to retire and write my book. But you mentioned about, you know, and I just want to put this there, because you mentioned about the kids and working with a certain population, and I can actually tell you, going on these author trips have been really some consciousness raising experience for me. You know, I think I'm getting more out of this experience than my audience is. And one of the things that impacted me more than anything, I had a school in Galesville, Alabama, public school, called me, the teacher, and said, well, we know we can't afford to bring you out there to speak, but the kids would raise money for you to come and speak. And I said, that's okay. I'm coming to Birmingham to do an event. I'll just come up to Galesville, which is about 2 hours away. And I did this in February. So, and I'm driving up to this school. And how many schools do you see now that run, that goes from kindergarten to high school? It's not very many.
Indeed.
But when I got in there to do that event with the 6th through the 12th graders in the gym, which was cold because they couldn't afford electricity to keep the gym warm during the winter time, and these kids sitting on this. On these bleachers in the auditorium with jackets and coats on, and I'm freezing myself. But prior to that, the teacher had told me that these kids, number one, they're 99% white and 1% Native American. 90% of them come from farming families. A large proportion of them doesn't have running water or indoor plumbing. A lot of them are being raised by their grandparents, and I'm going, and she says, this community has no McDonald's, no Dirt, no Burger King, no rec centers, no anything. The kids have nothing to do, and they have a large population of kids who use drugs, because they manufacture drugs because they don't have anything else to do. That city has nothing, absolutely nothing. So I'm sitting there talking to these kids, and these kids burnt a hole in my heart, because I donate to inner city schools and Hispanic school, and these are my three adopted schools, but I never thought about that. These kids are so needy, you know, because we always think about the inner city kids, but
right.
These kids are just, my heart just fell, because they were so open and receptive to what I was saying, and now they've read my book, because I donate the book because they can't afford it. And those are the type of things that really touch me. And those are the things that I really love doing. And it just touches my heart to do that sort of thing.
And you know,
and
you're
right. I just wanted to add that.
Thank you so much for adding that, because we don't think about that, certainly not in this day and age. I mean, it's mm-hmm. unimaginable that there's somebody who doesn't have hot and cold running water, doesn't have, you know, heat. I mean, for many people, it's a very real daily occurrence. But for mm-hmm. many people, that's just the old days, and it is not true.
Yes.
And clearly,
no, it's not.
What you're, the story that you're telling us, the experience that you're sharing, reminds us that even in today's world, and I say even in quotes, there is much work to be done, and there are many people who need assistance of all kinds.
Yeah, that it is. It really is. And I think, and I call these the forgotten children, because I was driving up that mountain, those Alabama mountains, over to my right, it was a little green sign that said, "This is the beginning of the Trail of Tears." So this is where the Trail of Tears, where the Native Americans came down that mountain going to Oklahoma and Arkansas from Alabama. And I just thought that was, so by the time riding down that hill, I was in tears, because it was just so symbolic of what that whole event was about.
You know, there are many people listening. There are many people, I'm sure, who've read your book and who have had the experience of abandonment in multiple ways, physical, emotional, financial, you name it, who have experienced those senses of loss. That sounds like that was almost the consistency in your life, was the inconsistency, was the many times that you were taken away or dropped into another location, even in your military experience. Many ways. And I wonder what you would like for people listening today to think about, particularly those who have had those experiences of loss and abandonment and don't think that they too can be resilient.
Well, you know, one of the fortunate pieces for me, and I always, no matter where I'm at or what I'm, you know, what station I am in life, and you know, even out on the road talking about it, I always go back to some of the lessons my grandmother taught me. There's always a one person that you can go back to, or something that they didn't say it that will just kind of get you to turn around, talk that thought process around. And it was my grandmother for me. She was a rock, because, you know, I had to really ask myself, you know, and I know this may sound a little crazy, and but there is always somebody out there that whose situation is worse or was worse than your own. Because I listened to my grandmother talk. My grandmother, and you know, to read my book, her entire lineage was lost. So a lot of times when she would tell me those stories, she would be in tears, you know, and I would, even though she tried to hide them, but she would be in tears because she had no sisters or brothers or aunts or uncles or parents or anybody. They were all lost through slavery and through the after effects of slavery. So listening to her story about her loss, it kind of can't even equal to the loss that I've experienced. You know, and that's why I knew I had to write the book and to do the DNA to find out where her lineage was. But listening to her story built resilience within me, because here's a person in her family who's been through some of the most traumatic events ever. I mean, ever. And here I have my story here and what I'm going through. The only thing that did was build me up and make me want to continue on. So it's, you know, it sometimes you have to go back and find that person who has said something or done something to impact your life and try to draw something from that. Because I know you know, a lot of times you do run into a lot of people who's not beneficial for you and your well-being. But it seems like there's always that one person that you can go back and draw from, you know. And I believe in role models. I really do. You know, a lot of people, you know, said, you know, that really not receptive to that whole role model theory, but I do. I truly believe in role, and my grandmother was mine, and she was the cause for my resilience, and I that's why I will continue to do what I'm doing and talking about it, and maybe in talking about it, I can help other people, because I get so many emails and so many messages and, you know, the love, outpouring the love of Pool to Souls, you know, and I just, that just makes me feel so good. So I'm always there to help, you know, if they ask me a question, I don't turn people away. I try to answer it to the best of my ability. And a lot of times it helped them say, wow, you've really helped me in answering that. So, you know, I hold on to that. My grandmother helped me so I can help somebody else.
And if you would, as we begin to close out our time today, clearly your grandmother was hugely important in your life. And a lot of times we, just as a society, have the capacity not to value the elderly, not to value grandparents. If you could say a sentence or two about that.
Yes, I do believe. I'm one of those people who believe that grandmothers are the most forgotten, underrated demographic there is. And they are the ones that hold wisdom. And I tell people, because I do genealogical research too, and I tell people, talk to the elderly people in your life now, because once their story is gone, once they're gone from this earth, you can't go back and capture that anymore. They're gone. And that story is buried with them. My grandmother used to take me out to the old slave cemetery and the old Native American cemetery, and she would tell me, you know, and I'm going to paraphrase her, not in her own words, but the best stories ever are laying right here. Mm-hmm. The best unheard stories that was never told are laying right here in the cemetery. And I truly believe that, because I get people who are trying to trace their ancestors, and they don't have a starting point because they didn't ask their parents or their grandparents, well, who was your father? Who was your mother? And those old artifacts, you know, that their parents or grandparents have passed on to them, believe me and trust me, that old quilt, that old brooch, that old whatever, it's a story behind it. I am sure of it.
Absolutely.
But if you don't ask, you're not going to get the story. And once that person is gone, you definitely won't get the story. So that's why I always tell people to talk to the most elder person in their family. Find out their story, because it is, sometimes I go to the VA and there's old people sitting around there, and they can tell, they have the most fabulous stories. And they say, well, my kid's not even interested in hearing it. And I think that's just sad, because these stories are awesome. These people who were born in the, now you have the generation, the last of the generation of people that was born in the 1920s, and they have amazing stories, because that means their parents were born in the 1880s, and I know they have beautiful stories, but if you don't capture them, it just won't happen.
They're lost. Phyllis, I'm going to ask you if you would share with the audience your website so folks can get more information about you and about the Quilt of Souls.
Yes, my website is www.quiltofsouls.org. .org.
Okay, terrific.
And my book is Quilt of Souls.
Wonderful. Phyllis, thank you. Phyllis Lawson, author of Quilt of Souls, thank you so much for joining us today. I expect that you will be back when you have completed the second writing of a follow-up to Quilt of Souls.
I sure will. If you will have me, I will definitely be back.
You have a standing invitation.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Brewer. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. Mind Talk is available to you daily via mindtalk.org, and the Mind Talk app is available for a free download. The way to be in touch with me, if you would like, is Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. And folks, I want you to remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. You take care.